listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to violent crimes. If this content affects you, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a detective who was involved in some of New South Wales' most infamous cases.
Entered the scene and it was a bloodbath everywhere. You can imagine two blokes being not only stabbed but bludgeoned to death with a baseball bat. It was horrific.
Former Deputy Commissioner Dave Owens is a 31-year veteran of the force. Dave was intimately involved in several high-intensity operations, including the infamous killing of Bra Boys member Tony Hines. We'll hear about that case, but to start, we're heading back to 1998 and to the violent shooting of police officer Chris Patrice.
We were on night shift and it was coming up Christmas Eve, 23rd of December. Doing the night shifts, I was the inspector and had a car crew out. So we were actually going up to get a cup of coffee because we were at Rose Bay. There was an all-night, very good coffee place just near Rushcutters Bay. At the time, the boys had followed a car. You can imagine Rushcutters Bay around that time. There's no traffic. There's no one around. Why are you around at this hour of the morning? So what we didn't know was earlier in the night, in the early hours of the morning, some people came into the eastern suburbs with the intention of actually going and shooting the King's Cross drug enforcer, who was known by most people as Tongan Sam. So there was a drug war going on, and they'd aimed to go and kill him. So on the way there, Johnny Fotopoulos, who was the senior constable, and Chris Patrice, who was the constable in the car crew, came across their vehicle. They simply followed it up Alma Street, which is where the White City tennis courts are. They wanted to have a look at who was in the car and what they're doing. Four of them have jumped out of the car and absolutely bolted across the sports field. Chris has climbed the fence to follow the bloke, the main offender, Michael Canaan. And as Chris is up the top of the fence, so it's the mesh fence they use for tennis courts, so it's fairly high. As he's at the top of the fence, Michael Canaan has turned around and shot him through the right thigh and then shot him in the wrist. Now, in the process of doing that, Chris has fallen and broken his ankle at the same time. So he was out of action. So Constable Fotopoulos is then engaged in a shootout with Michael Canaan. And Michael Canaan was shot in both legs. He was shot in the buttocks and he was also shot in the wrist. In Canaan shooting back at the police, because he was injured at the time, Canaan also shot himself in the foot. How I became involved was, as I said, I was simply going for a cup of coffee, see what the boys are doing, were they all right, was it a slow night, and what were they doing for the next couple of hours on the shift. So I drove down the road a little bit behind them, but it's dead still down there. You could hear everything. So when they drove up the street, I heard the first gunshot go off. So I was still in the main drag where White City is. So I lit the car up, in other words, put the lights on top of the car to brighten it up and say, boys, I'm here. If you head them across my way, they're fine. And then all hell broke loose. You could see literally in the light, it was like a movie with the gunshots going off left, right and centre. So went around to Alma Street, followed the sounds of the gunshot and saw them running across the fields. But I also saw Chris was lying in, it's like a ditch where they keep the sand for the cricket pitches. He'd fallen down and in there. So I could only hear him yelling. Saw Johnny Fotopoulos with his hand on one offender, pointing a gun into basically a black square, which was the tennis courts. Mate, what the hell's going on? Needed to know. So John's arrested the offender at the same time as shooting Michael Canaan. So the guy's got some guts on him. And I believe under the pressure, John has saved Chris's life by remaining so calm as he did. So I got there. First of all, I had to secure Canaan because we didn't know where the firearm was. It was as black as anything down there. So in talking to Canaan, he was in that much pain. He indicated where the firearm was because I was worried that he was lying on it. He'd still have access to it. Secured the firearm and then went across to Chris to render first aid to him. We set up multiple crime scenes because you can imagine we got a bloke lying with, what, four shots in him on a tennis court. You got a firearm near him. You got Johnny Fotopoulos at gunpoint with another offender who'd been shooting, and you got the other bloke, Chris, lying in the cricket pitch. To manage that took a number of hours. We still had two guys on the run because we knew there were four of them. So setting up multiple crime scenes, doing searches, set up a command post, got state crime in, worked our way through, obviously got Canaan under guard up to the hospital, got Chris treated very quickly as well, and then state crime spoke to the bloke who Johnny Fotopoulos had arrested at the scene. Now, what it turns out, going back through, we didn't firstly know that they were on their way to go and shoot Tong and Sam. That came up later. But what we then realised through doing search warrants on safes in houses and just forensics who came to the scene and were fantastic, Canaan, Rasuni and Kazi and an unknown bloke back in July 1998. So we go back from December back to July. They were driving around Five Dock. And a lot of your listeners will remember this incident. They stopped near a Five Dock hotel. Three mates were punching on out the front of the hotel. So one of them yelled out, "Oh, I'll punch on." One of the, being blunt, one of the Aussie guys has yelled back a racial slur to Canaan and his mates. So Canaan has jumped out of the car, produced a gun and shot four shots into the crowd. Now, he's done it just because a comment was made. This is what the bloke's like. One of the males was shot in the arm. A bloke by the name of Wright was shot in the lower abdomen. A bloke by the name of Hurl was shot in the lower left chest. Now, both Wright and Hurl died in hospital the next day from the injuries that were inflicted by Michael Canaan. The fourth shot went through one of their shirts and missed completely as we went back. So the firearm from the White City shooting was matched to that shooting. Putting things together a little bit more, at the time, there was a crook running around that basically he developed his own group, which was called DK Boys. Now, Danny Karam was his name. Just before the shooting at White City, Danny Karam's boys, which included mainly Middle Eastern young males, they used to recruit. And what they basically did was sale and distribution of cocaine in the inner west, and they absolutely used intimidation and violence to expand their trade. Canaan and Co were all part of DK's boys. Canaan organised a meeting of the group, and whilst Danny Karam sat in his car, he was armed at the same time. While sitting in his car, he was ambushed by his own blokes who shot him 16 times in the head. Now, they wanted to make sure they did the job. So that's out of a simple car stop down in Rushcutters Bay on the 23rd of December 1998, takes you back to the shooting of these two young blokes out the front of Five Dock to Danny Karam's murder. And you go, this is what these people are like. They're driving around in the middle of the night looking for a target to go and shoot and kill. That was their idea of fun.
So this happened in 98. Am I right in saying, Dave, that Canaan didn't end up being sentenced for this particular shooting of the police until 2006? Is that right, or have I got that wrong?
Yeah, no, that's right.
What's the delay? What's all that about?
He had other trials. He had to go through the murder trials, so it gets put in priority. So at the time, there was also a problem. In 1999, the White City shooting, because they deal with the Five Dock shooting of Danny Karam and the White City, completely separate trials. They cannot be held together. So that delays it. But in 1999, the matter was put in November before Magistrate at Redfern, Pat O'Shea. And I quote, what she said was, the circumstances in which Constables Patrice and Fotopoulos became involved with Canaan and cohorts indicate a police harassment of youth. She said the cops, if they hadn't have stopped them, wouldn't have been shot.
So he goes to trial. At that stage, I think I'm right in saying he's already serving two consecutive life sentences.
Three life sentences. So the two guys at Five Dock.
Yes.
And Denny Karam.
Yes.
And then he goes for the White City shootings, and he gets 12 years on top of that. So he's got three life sentences plus 12.
Plus 12. Is he still inside?
Yeah, he's not going to be released.
He's not going to be released. Yep. Now, just for the benefit of the listeners too, 98 when Karan's running around, Canaan rather, running around shooting coppers, having shot and killed two. How old is he? He's not an old bloke, is he?
He's very young.
He's 19, 20?
He'd be 20, 22, somewhere around
and
there.
And was he well known to those in the job at that time? Or I suppose at that age you haven't really accumulated much in the way of...
He was known through intelligence a lot because of Denny Karam's group, DK Boys, because the police intelligence group does a lot of work behind the scenes on linkages. And Denny Karam was linked through the DK Boys to Michael Canaan, to all of these others. But to convict them, you've got to put them in a time, date and place, basically with a gun in their hand or somebody turning, giving evidence against them.
So, Dave, we just circle back around. You've arrived on the scene. Fellow officer Chris Patrice has been shot a couple of times. He's fallen off the fence. He's broken his ankle. You've arrived, and there's a bit of an interesting exchange between yourself and Chris at that time.
Well, again, it's pitch black. I got Chris there screaming. Heat of the moment, I had no gloves, so I had to put my hands straight over him to stop the flow of the blood. Chris is an absolute stand-up guy, he's aces. And I said, mate, for God's sake, basically, there aren't any bullet holes, they're straight through. And he's screaming, and I'm thinking, hang on, what's going on? And I'm trying to adjust myself and everything, and I was actually standing on the ankle that he'd broken, which he was in that much pain he couldn't tell me.
So the bullet holes at that stage, the pain of the shooting was nothing compared to the pain of you standing on the broken ankle.
You get a 100-kilo guy standing on your busted ankle, and it's going to hurt.
I'm sure Davey's reminded you of that now and again, perhaps over a beer since.
Yeah, afterwards. As I said, he's a lovely bloke. And as I said, Johnny Fotopoulos absolutely saved his life by remaining cool, calm, under pressure, returning the fire. And, to this day, Chris is thankful that John was there.
Dave, I could take you forward to 2003. You're the commander of Maroubra Police Station. Now, for those that aren't listening in from Sydney, New South Wales, Maroubra is a beachside suburb south of Coogee. You've got sort of, Bondi, Coogee, Maroubra, the main beaches down through there. You're the commander of that station. Dave, what does that entail? What's a typical day look like for someone in that role?
It was my first local area command, and I'd say, hands down, it was one of my hardest because geographically it was so big. It went from La Perouse through Maroubra up to Randwick, so you had New South Wales University as well. You had the Bra Boys down at Bondi, you had the Housing Commission behind there, and it was a very big transient population. On your day, you had a limited number of detectives working out of the office. We had the Special Operations Group working out of there, General Duties, who are pushed very, very hard and just do a wonderful job. And as I found, I also had Bob Carr in my electorate. He was a local member. It's different when you're policing the Premier's local area because when things happen, they've got to be informed, but you've also got to protect the Premier from people that drop down to his address, want to talk to him, want to give him things, stuff like that. So politics come into play as well.
We think of, particularly, of course, those just outside of Sydney, I think of the eastern suburbs of Sydney, we think of the Bellevue Hills, we think of, the North Bondi, Vaucluse, very, very salubrious, expensive areas. You start to go a little further south into areas like Maroubra, La Perouse, particularly 20 years ago, these were tough areas. A lot of crime, high crime areas. And as a commander there, you would be getting called out to sort of oversee a lot of some of the more high profile or more serious crimes. You might not be having the hands-on investigation per se, but you're on the ground, you're overseeing it and then liaising back through.
Your first local area command it's yours. You want to make an impact. So you are very hands-on. At your second, third and fourth local area command, you may not go to as many jobs, but I went to every job. It was also a time when they had the Prince Henry Hospital was still a hospital, the open grounds, the golf course out there. If you go there now, it's high-rise buildings everywhere. At Maroubra, it's all changed. Long Anzac Parade, it's all changed. It's high-density housing. Back then, it was lower socioeconomic people down there, and right out at La Perouse, you had a very active population. And when I say active, active in crime, but also trying to do the best they could through the little school that was there.
So talking about that sort of, like you said, Dave, you know, first command, you're wanting to be seen as much for the troops as well. That's a big part of that. There's a case that you're involved in down there in Coogee, investigating the killing of a member of a very infamous group of locals down there known as the Bra Boys. Can you have a chat to us about that particular case?
Yeah, sure. It was about August 2003, and you've got a group called the Bra Boys. As you said, they're an infamous Sydney beachside surf group. They basically recognised by the tattoo, my brother's keeper was tattooed across their neck. And what they basically said is, we are so tight, we look after the young ones here because they come from housing commission. We give them what their parents can't give, and we set up the social scene. Now, you had Kobe Abberton at the time. He was a very well-known big wave surfer. That's how he was making his living. He's very good at it as well. But the Bra Boys were meant to be this tight-knit group looking after each other. Now, some of the names in the group were Tony Hines and Kobe's brother, Jai Abberton. Now, Tony Hines, he was one of the most violent people I have ever come across, and he was so unpredictable when he was either on drugs or alcohol. You just couldn't pick. Most people, you know when they're going to do something. This guy was just, you know, M-A-triple-D. He really was. Now, Jai Abberton and Tony Hines were mates. However, Tony Hines, for some reason, believed that Jai Abberton had slept with his wife. So as a result of it, he made threats against Jai Abberton and his new girlfriend. And as a result of that, Jai shot him three times in the head and once in the hand, and then disposed of the body over a cliff at North Maroubra. Now, my recollection is how I came into it was Jai did have a new girlfriend. She witnessed what went on and became, not paranoid, but really distressed at what could happen to her. And I fully understand that. We've gone and seen her as a result of a disturbance, and the story started to unfold. She was extremely distressed, started rambling about what had occurred, and we're thinking, hang on, this isn't, you know, putting two to two together. So her story was straight up that Jai had shot and killed Hines, as they believe Hines was going to rape her and was going to then kill both of them. And as I said, she believed Abberton disposed of the body. So at the scene that we found, so at North Maroubra, her block of units was directly opposite the park. There were drag marks across the park, and putting two and two together, okay, if he's disposed of a body, where would you dispose of it? Over a cliff. When we went to the edge of the cliff, the body was actually under the cliff, but you could see part of it protruding out. We had to get rescue in to find out, was it a rock fisherman or was it actually Tony Hines? We found out it was Hines. He was actually naked, fully naked at the bottom of the cliff except for one shoe. Now, I don't know the significance of that other than obviously Jai had taken the opportunity when he was naked to shoot him, and he has done that and then disposed of the body. Abberton was subsequently arrested and charged. He was extremely concerned that Tony Hines was going to kill him, and the only reason why he killed him before was because he believed his girlfriend was going to be raped and killed, and he was going to be killed, and he'd dispose of the body. As I said, it was supposedly because Jai, incorrectly, the rumour was, had slept with Hines's wife at the time, and this was supposedly payback.
So, Dave, just for a bit of clarity, Jai Abberton admits to shooting this chap three times in the head, once in the hand, kills him. Some would be questioning, well, okay, how do you then do that, then dump a body over the cliff to get rid of it, and then still come back and claim self-defence. So how's that reconciled legally?
Yeah, it's all one act. So he was that scared that he's taken the action that he has, self-defence. He's killed him. And in that act, he has dragged the body across and disposed of it. Now, if he had have had somebody come in and help him dispose of the body, well, then that person would have been charged with actually accessory after the fact, i.e. disposing of the body. So it's seen as one complete act from the shooting, the death, and the disposal of the body. It's not he shot him, that's a crime, and he disposed of the body. It's all one act.
His relationship with the police would not have been a particularly rosy one. His trust of police wouldn't have been great. So it would have been relatively easy for his defence counsel to say, look, of course my client wasn't going to call up the police and say there's a dead bloke in my lounge room. So you said a little bit of panic and it all sort of flows over and away we go. But the case itself goes back to what happened in the lounge room in the house.
It's a single case.
Yes.
That there was no love lost between the Abbotons and the cops.
Yes.
And he probably didn't think he'd get a fair deal if he rang up and said, hey, guess what? Tony Irons is dead in my living room and I shot him.
Now, Dave, you're commanding an area like Maroubra, which geographically, I mean, it's spread out to a degree, but when we talk about the Bra Boys and their hold, a gang like that, their hold over Maroubra, we're talking a fairly small sort of a location in some degree. I'm just wondering, Dave, if you could sort of shine a light on that relationship that the police have with a group like that, very high profile, a gang, basically. Do you foster that relationship? How do you work that from a policing perspective in an area like Maroubra 20 years ago?
Yeah, 20 years ago, you can try and foster it, but they didn't want a bar of us and we didn't want a bar of them, basically. Whenever we dealt with them, it was in a violent confrontation normally. It was never, you know, we'd like to work with you and run programs. We had the PCYC, but they were at Pagewood and they're very tribal and they stuck to Maroubra Beach and Maroubra. To put any programs in were fruitless, basically, because they weren't interested in reform at that stage. What they were was a group who they thought they looked after each other. They looked after the young kids, and to a degree they did, but then when they got to a certain age, it started with violent crimes, break-and-enters, you know, street assault, stuff like that. It was met with a show of force by the cops, you know, back then, absolutely.
Was there a dust-up in a Coogee hotel sometime after this between perhaps off-duty police and members of the Bra Boys?
Yeah, it was actually my first day as the local area commander at Maroubra. And we were down at Goulburn Academy. We all go down for an attestation parade. And that night, the Waverley police had a function. I think it was at the Ramwick or Maroubra RSL. And the Bra Boys had a function on another floor. And as they were all leaving, the doors opened and all hell broke loose in a melee.
I think from memory, I think it was that Randwick RSL just right next to the Coogee Oval there. You go upstairs to above now the McDonald's there. And you're right, I've been over the years to a few sort of rugby type functions and bits and pieces there. And I think that was it. And they spilled down onto Coogee Bay Road, unfortunately, at the same time.
And both parties had consumed alcohol. Mm. And a fair melee resulted.
We're going back to 2003, to the killing of two men for our next case. Can you walk us through what happened?
15th of September, a gentleman by the name of Ram Tiwari was sharing a Kingsford unit with two other university students. So the three of them were all Singaporean nationals. They were all being sponsored by the government, which they do to come out and go through uni, gain the qualifications and go back home. What happened was, the two engineering students were beaten to death with a baseball bat and stabbed at the same time. And Tiwari, this Ram Tiwari who lived there, in sequential events, what happened was he wakes up, finds the two deceased, allegedly barricades himself in the room, and he calls 000 and tells them that he's found his two flatmates deceased. So general duties go down, detectives go down. I got the phone call, boss, you need to come and see this one. So when I went down there, suited up at the back, by suited up, I mean put the forensic overalls on, the suits they got, entered the scene, and it was a bloodbath everywhere. You can imagine two blokes being not only stabbed, but bludgeoned to death with a baseball bat. It was horrific in what we found. Initially at the scene, Tiwari, we had to treat him as a victim because he rang and said, look, I was asleep. I then barricaded myself in because I found my two flatmates dead. But we also, you just have this thing at the back, you know, where the hair stand up on the back of your neck. You go, nah, look, he's a person of interest as well. Let's get his story down. Let's start doing some of the forensics. So he was either the luckiest bloke alive because his two flatmates had been bludgeoned to death and he slept through it, or he was a perpetrator. So we've kept him in custody, taken him up, made sure he was looked after, and then what we had to do was work the crime scene and at the same time get his story down. What is the story you allege? Tell us in detail what the story is, so then we can start going through it. When I say we, the detectives can start going through it and start finding inconsistencies through that story. So he wasn't in custody for, I think, about the first 48 hours. He came and he assisted police. Now, the Singaporean representative came out here from government and looked after him, made sure that he was right. They were very, very good. So we knew where he was all the time. He actually went to a friend's place. We made sure that he was there. We made sure that he was looked after because we didn't want him going anywhere. So what we then found was, working through it, he was a Singaporean student who's attending the university. Okay, that's good. He was actually failing his subjects and he was falsifying the documents to send back to Singapore because he was from a fairly well-off family, and it would have been a big loss of face for him to have the government paying and then him losing, you know, failing through the course. It's alleged that his flatmates found out that what he was doing, and he was going to let the family know that he was actually failing the courses. So again, the loss of face. He actually owed one of the flatmates $5,000. So then it goes, and the detectives found that he'd actually purchased the baseball bat 2 days prior. The detective going through then went and got his service record because he served in the Singaporean army and he actually went through commando training. So we started putting all these facts together, and he was charged at that time. We're going back in time saying, look, this is what happened. So Tiwari went through two separate trials, and one of them was a mistrial, and then the second one, he was found guilty on two charges of murder in the Supreme Court, and he was sentenced in 2009 to 48 years jail. So what happened was in 2012... he and his family were going to appeal no matter what. They appealed everything. They mistrialed everything. They tried to get out on technicalities on everything. I guess if you're a parent, you would try and do that with your son. So in 2012, he appeared in the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal, which is only three judges sitting. It's no jury. And they quashed his conviction, citing a reasonable doubt. Now, it's interesting in what they found, because what they found was there's considerable suspicion about his version of events. So they didn't actually believe all of his version of events, but that was both to its content and the tone in which it was given. They described the Crown case as it was plausible, what they put forward. It was very plausible, with Tiwari having the means to both kill the men and purchase the baseball bat, and he was trained as a commando. So again, he knew how to use a knife, he owed him money, and he had the opportunity, and he bought the baseball bat. But what happens is you have two deceased who can't talk for themselves, and you have Tiwari, who's alive, so he gives a version of what he found, which is the two deceased on the day, he claimed, were acting extremely, behaving unusually. And one of them had actually purchased a baseball bat for protection just before he was killed. Now, was it protection from Tiwari, or was it protection from an unknown person? And that's where the reasonable doubt came in. The police have to talk on behalf of the dead, but sometimes you just can't completely wipe out a version that somebody is telling to the court when you can't talk to the people involved. You know, why did you buy a baseball bat? And his explanation could have been, because my flatmate was scaring the bejesus out of me, that's why I bought it. But we didn't have that. So there was a lack of forensic evidence at the house, but they believed Tiwari had greater knowledge and or greater complicity in the murders. However, there was a reasonable doubt that a third party could have also been involved. So therefore, it was quashed. So basically for, you know, nearly 10 years, this, and I know the detective very well, it consumed his life with everything that went on, the technicalities, the military, trying to get access to the military records, you know, basically putting the picture back together. And then this guy comes and says, well, you know, these guys were acting strangely on the day of, and he bought a baseball bat 2 days before as well. So not me.
Even if his fingerprints were all over the baseball bat, I guess the argument would be, yeah, but he bought it.
He lived there. He lived there. He lived in the house.
He's going to have DNA
fingerprints
everywhere.
There. Yeah, yeah, of course they were. Was his DNA there? Yeah, of course it was.
Yeah. It's not going to be a case, is it, where DNA is going to tip it one way or the other, to be fair.
No. Did he walk through the crime scene? Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Because he had to come out.
Yeah.
You know, everything that was put forward was then could be refuted because the guy lived there.
Mm.
And what you do with the three judges in the criminal appeal is you take out any emotion.
Yes.
See, with a jury, you can paint the picture, which I painted. You know, he's falsifying his records. He owes $5,000. He's got commando training. He bought the baseball bat. You know, he allegedly slept through it. And the jury go, I don't believe that. Whereas the judges are, and rightly so, stick to the law, the facts of what occurred. And as I've said, is the dead can't talk for themselves.
So, Dave, you had a 31-year career and you medically retired in 2012. Now, can I say, Dave, you attained the rank of Deputy Commissioner in New South Wales, which is, you know, you're one branch of the tree above the top. There's a handful of people who get to that level of commissioned officer. But 2012, after 31 years medically retired, that must have been a big decision to make.
Yeah, it was a massive decision. Look, it was, I guess, taken out of my hands to some extent because of physical injuries. I have a busted vertebrae in layman's terms, and I've had the same shoulder reconstructed 3 times. So the choice was taken out of my hands to a degree. A lot of blokes end up a lot worse than me coming through, but I decided, look, it was time for me to call it quits, you know, and try something different.
Dave, those injuries that led to that medical retirement, were they injuries that occurred on the job?
Yeah, they were. Look, it's sort of funny in a way. I wish it never happened, but the guy ended up being the nicest country guy you'd ever want to see again. Buddy Eastern Beaches nearly killed me as the commander there. We got Randwick Racecourse in. And we're talking, you know, back a while ago, is the public area there wasn't what it used to be, you know, wasn't back then what it is now. And blokes used to get there, they used to absolutely just pour it down their throats. And we had a couple of blokes from the country, and of course they were two brothers. They were two bookends, 6'9" and 6'11". And they'd had an absolute skinful, started taking their clothes off, started punching blokes, walking past them and everything. So we decided to go and grab them because they were in the distance. So I've run up with another bloke, and as I've got closer, you know, the eyes are going up and up, and I'm going, oh, this is going to hurt me. And I grabbed him, and as I grabbed him, he's gone, when I get hold of you, I'm going to kill you, because he was just pissed. He didn't know. He couldn't. I don't think he even recognised that I was in the cops. So I thought, all right, what's the easiest way? If he can't see me, he can't hit me. So I sprayed him with the OC spray in the eyes, and there's this bloke 6'9" swinging, and I'm 5'9", ducking everything I can. But he ended up grabbing me, and we twisted when we fell to the ground, and that's, he was literally that big and that heavy. That's what fractured my vertebrae. And as a result of that, they want to go and put a titanium cage and all of that. I'll put up with it until it really, really is unbearable. But, you know, when he sobered up, he's actually sitting in the dock with him. He's actually the nicest bloke in the world. He was a country bloke. He just had a skinful and just couldn't control himself.
And a big unit.
Oh, he's a massive rig. Yeah, as you say, in the distance, he looked good. It's when I caught up with him that I went, oh, geez, this is going to hurt.
And what year was that then, Dave?
Oh, geez, we're going back to about 2005. And I just pain managed it. through. You know, you just put up with it and you go through, and then of all things, stupidly slipped and tore me shoulder out, got it reconstructed, didn't take, throwing a tennis ball and it ripped out again. And then, you know, third one, I went, look, you know, someone's trying to tell me you can't keep doing this job. So I just retired and started my own business.
And that's 7 years after the incident at the racecourse. And,
yeah.
And also something that folks perhaps wouldn't be aware of, Dave, even at the rank of deputy commissioner, from a physical perspective, you have to be able to pretty much attain, this is how it always was, I think it was in this yep. time, you have to be able to attain the same physical performance as a 19, 20-year-old constable that's come out yep. of the academy.
Yep, as the rank of constable.
So when you start yep. carrying injuries like that, and none of us are getting any younger at that stage after 30-year service, if you can't meet the physical requirements required for a constable, even though you're deputy commissioner, that's pretty much it. Is that
yep.
sort of
yeah? It is? And it's yeah. pain management. You know, you're waking up and you're broken and busted every day, and you're just going, "Do I need to be doing this anymore?" And that's what it came to. And the commissioner was really good at the time. And you know, it's what labels you. It's what you identify as. But then one door closes and another one opens.
We were saying earlier too, Dave, you found that so many of those skills that you picked up and developed during your time in the police, communication, man management, you know, investigations, you've sort of brought all that together, both with your degrees, but also now with your business. And you're very motivated, you were saying, to assisting and working with police and mentoring police through that process themselves.
Yeah, it's not just police, it's any of the emergency services. I have a lot to do with the RFS now and working through them. It's people come out with a perspective of you're identified in emergency services, so that's your identity. And what I try and say to them is that was your identity. What you learnt in that phase, now take across. You know, you ran a team, you supervised, you managed, you've got all these skills, you're top-notch investigators. You've got these skills. If you choose to go back into the workforce, actually see yourself for the value that you're worth. And equally, if you can't work anymore, that's also okay. And that's really important. So I work with quite a few people now, and I get great delight in seeing them going back and actually thriving in the workforce.
Dave, I just want to thank you so very much for coming in here to the studio and having a chat to us this afternoon. I want to thank you, you know, for your service. Thank you for that 31 years of service to predominantly the good people of the eastern suburbs of Sydney, of which I was one during that time. It's been a privilege to have you on board, Dave, and thanks for coming in for a chat. And I know a lot of people that will listen to this will take a lot from it.
Absolute pleasure.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.